Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to Julie Bishop. Julie Bishop is well known to all of you, so I will introduce her very briefly. Ms. Bishop studied law at Adelaide University, became a lawyer, and was the managing partner for Clayton Utz in Perth before entering Parliament as the member for Curtin in 1998. She held a number of senior positions in the Howard government and ended up in the Howard government in the cabinet as Minister for Education. Since late 2007, Julie Bishop has been Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party and also Deputy Leader of the Opposition, and currently the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs. And tonight she's going to talk for us on freedom and prosperity, the Liberal Party's legacy. Julie Bishop, you may as well.
Well, thank you, Jared and Anne, for the kind opportunity to speak here this evening. My apologies for running a little late, but the demands of the media are such that you take the call. 60 years ago, during the 1949 federal election campaign, as Australia and the world continued the struggle to rebuild after the bleak years of the Great Depression and the Second World War, the leader of the Liberal Party, Robert Menzies, defined the choice the Australian people had to make at that critical election. In his policy speech, Menzies said, "We must choose our road. Upon our decision will depend the future and fate of the nation. Every extension of government power and control means less freedom of choice for the citizen. Government activities are monopolist. Monopolies exclude choice. No choice for the producer, no choice for the employee, no choice for the customer. The abolition of choice is the death of freedom." And in the end, what happens? Having chosen the socialist road, to what journey's end do we come? To the master state, the one employer, the one planner, the one controller. In that state, as in the monstrous totalitarian states which have disfigured the history of the 20th century, all free choice will have gone. The case against socialism is a deadly one. It will be my contention that Australians face, again, one of the most important ideological choices in 60 years. Tonight, I invite you to choose our road. The world is facing a global economic shock, and the comparisons are being made with the Great Depression. Only time will tell whether the current global economic challenges are anywhere near the scale and magnitude of the 1930s. The IMF has said global economic conditions are the worst since the Great Depression, and that many advanced economies will suffer deep recession for the first time in 60 years, with predictions of the ranks of the unemployed swelling by the millions throughout the developed and developing world. In the United States, the world's largest economy, GDP fell by a startling 6.2% annual rate in the fourth quarter of 2008. The Dow Jones has fallen by almost 50% from its October 2007 peak. 44 banks have failed since 2007. Unemployment is growing by 150,000 per week, and the US deficit is now measured in the trillions. Japan is in one of its worst recessions ever, with its economy shrinking by an annual rate of 12.7% in the fourth quarter of 2008, and the nation's trade deficit is now the largest on record. In the United Kingdom, the national debt now exceeds £2 trillion, over half of which has come from the nationalisation of Lloyds Bank and the Royal Bank of Scotland. Analysts suggest that this increase in UK debt to 150% of national income is a level not seen since the darkest hours of World War II. With growth stalling in China, there are predictions that up to 50 million people could lose their jobs this year alone, raising concerns about increasing social unrest. Given that the US, the UK, China and Japan are among our biggest trade and investment partners, this is grim news for Australia. While there are obvious dangers in seeking to draw parallels between the challenges of today and the catastrophic events of the 1930s and 1940s, it is nonetheless worth recalling that the Great Depression unleashed a wave of global crises, and some are suggesting there is reason to fear that the current financial crisis could also lead to a period of global instability. Renowned historian and Harvard professor Niall Ferguson argued in his 2006 book, The War of the World, that his study of the events of the 20th century had shown that there were three preconditions for widespread conflict in that century. Ethnic disintegration, violence was worse in areas of mounting ethnic tension. Economic volatility, the greater the magnitude of economic shocks, the more likely conflict was. And empires in decline, when structures of imperial rule crumbled, battles for political power were most bloody. In his recent article titled The Axis of Upheaval, Ferguson again draws on his conclusions to argue that those three preconditions are now being met. And I quote, economic volatility plus ethnic disintegration plus an empire in decline. That combination is about the most lethal in geopolitics. We now have all three. The age of upheaval starts now. It is clear that the economic empire of the United States is facing serious decline, and if that impacts on its military capabilities, there is obvious potential for a power vacuum to develop in many regions of the world. Long dormant border and territorial disputes could suddenly be revitalized in the absence of a dominant world power. A resurgent Russia and its allies would undoubtedly seek to extend its regional influence, while countries with large cash reserves, such as China and some Middle Eastern countries, are extending their influence through strategic investments internationally. There will be a clash of national interests in the years ahead as part of the world's economic power shifts from the United States and Europe to nations such as China, India, the Middle East, and possibly Russia. As Ferguson concludes in his article, the problem is that, as in the 1930s, most countries are looking inward, grappling with the domestic consequences of the economic crisis and paying little attention to the wider world crisis. This is true even of the United States, which is now so preoccupied with its own economic problems that countering global upheaval looks like an expensive luxury. History tells us that in times of crisis, our choices as a nation are more critical and any mistakes are more profound in their impact. With world financial markets in turmoil, the banking sector freezing credit and stifling global economic activity, and economies in recession, governments around the world are seeking solutions. So let's turn to Australia. After 16 years of unprecedented growth and a decade of wide-ranging reforms in our economy, Australia is better placed than most other countries to weather the storm. There are many more options available to the Rudd government to respond to an economic downturn than most other countries, because the Rudd government inherited not only decades of reform, but also the strongest set of economic indicators of virtually any incoming federal government in Australia's history. The Australian economy has been dubbed internationally as the miracle economy, the wonder down under. But that was no accident. It came from a decade of hard decisions and prudent fiscal management of the economy. Recall how, on his first day as Treasurer, Peter Costello found the national accounts in disarray. there was a Commonwealth government debt of $96 billion and a budget deficit of $10 billion at a time when the total budget was just $150 billion. The interest payment on the huge debt was approaching $10 billion a year and was a heavy drag on the ability of the government to fund essential services. Inflation was running at 3.7% after averaging over 5% under Labor. The Reserve Bank cash rate was 7.5%, coming off a 17% high. Unemployment was 8.4%, having hit 11%, or a million people unemployed under Labor. In contrast, on the day Mr Rudd and Mr Swan took office 11 years later, there was zero Commonwealth public sector debt, although it had taken the Howard government 10 years to pay off the entire $96 billion. There was a $20 billion budget surplus and national savings of over $70 billion. Inflation was at 3%, interest rates at 6.75%, unemployment at 4.4% and heading south. So Mr Rudd was handed an economy free of Commonwealth debt and with a healthy surplus, where over 2 million jobs had been created during the Howard years, where net household wealth had grown fourfold and average real wages, minus 1.8% during the 13 years of Labor, were 21.5% under Howard. Our credit rating, downgraded twice under Labor, was upgraded twice under Howard to AAA. Yet, rather than build on the economic legacy it had inherited, the Rudd government went into overdrive in seeking to blacken the economic credentials of the previous government. I have previously likened Mr Rudd to a latter-day Winston Smith, the Ministry of Truth bureaucrat in Orwell's 1984. For Mr Rudd set about busily rewriting the past to support Labor's propaganda about the state of the economy. Whenever Winston Smith rewrote history, the truth was shunted down a memory hole to be incinerated. Mr Rudd, in trying to shove the national accounts down the memory hole, was pursuing a cheap and trivial short-term political boost. By talking down the economy and talking up inflation and interest rates, he urged a tightening of monetary policy, apparently oblivious to the fact that a financial crisis had been underway in the United States since mid to late 2007, and the rest of the world was doing precisely the opposite and easing monetary policy. Having misread the looming downturn in the first half of 2008 by chasing an inflation monster that failed to materialise, the Rudd government was stunned by the events in September 2008 after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Ever since, it has been telling the Australian people that it's taking decisive action. However, it's becoming alarmingly apparent that the Rudd government simply does not know what to do. Judging by its ill-considered, contradictory and panicked reactions to date, it is clear that the government has had no consistent guiding philosophy underpinning its decisions. Until now. The government now has a philosophy that can guide it, courtesy of an essay written by the Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, published in the February edition of The Monthly. The Prime Minister's essay should be mandatory reading for every concerned citizen. As tedious and confused as the overblown socialist-leaning rhetoric is, it represents an all-out attack on the principles that have underpinned Australia's economic success and on the very policies embraced and understood by governments of a centre-left and centre-right leaning across the world over the past 30 years. Policies that have taken millions of people out of poverty around the world and built dynamic economies in developed and developing nations. Mr Rudd rails against what he calls neoliberalism, blaming it and the political home of neoliberalism in Australia, the Liberal Party, for the current global financial crisis and the challenges currently facing Australia. Deliberately, I assume, overlooking the fact that principles of free markets, open economies, deregulation and liberalised labour markets have been a feature of governments of both persuasions around the world, including in Britain, France, New Zealand, even China, and of course closer to home, the governments of Hawke and Keating. As John Howard himself noted in the inaugural John Howard Lecture to the Menzies Research Centre on 19th February last, almost 30 years ago, there were five great reforms that Australia needed to undertake. I quote, "We needed to deregulate our financial system, fundamentally change our tax system, make our labour markets freer, reduce excessively high levels of protection, and rid the government of ownership of commercial enterprises." By 2007, these five great reforms had been achieved. All these reforms are now slammed by Mr. Rudd as part of the neoliberal experiment of the past 30 years that he claims has failed our nation. But what makes Mr. Rudd's essay all the more startling is the 180-degree about-face that it represents for him in just a matter of 15 months. You will recall that prior to the 2007 election, Mr. Rudd promoted himself through an expensive advertising campaign as an economic conservative, draped in virtually all the policies of John Howard. Mr. Rudd shamelessly adopted a Me Too approach to all but a handful of election promises, as well as a commitment to tax cuts, budget surpluses, and zero government debt. The jibe that he was John Howard Light was utterly believable for many Australians. Importantly, this was tacit acknowledgement and recognition by Mr. Rudd of the success of the Howard years. For the first 10 months of the new Rudd government, it was an orgy of reviews, summits, inquiries, green papers and white papers. As one of my colleagues said, Rudd hit the ground reviewing. But the lack of decisions and policies made it almost impossible to test the credentials of this self-proclaimed economic conservative government, or to ascertain what this government or this Prime Minister really stood for. After all, the Prime Minister had apparently forgiven the Member for Melbourne, Lindsay Tanner's declaration in his maiden speech, "I am a socialist," and had appointed him the Minister for Deregulation, a classic case of Orwellian doublethink, if ever there was one. But the signs of the economic conservatism facade began to slip, with the government's reckless attack on the Howard economic legacy that destroyed business and consumer confidence from early 2008, as they talked down the economy, scaring people about inflation and interest rates. The consequences of this ill-considered attack are still being felt, because consumer and business confidence have never recovered. But now the camouflage has been dropped and Mr. Rudd has revealed himself, not as an economic conservative, but as an old-style interventionist, prepared to take us back to the dreary doctrines of socialism. Now, the Deputy Prime Minister is reported to have boasted recently to the World Economic Forum in Switzerland that other countries could learn from Australia's regulations, which are among the best in the world, and with our well-regulated banking sector, had protected Australia from experiencing the kind of problems in its housing market that had been seen in the United States. The Prime Minister cannot sustain an argument that neoliberalism was simultaneously responsible for problems in the Australian economy while also protecting Australia from the worst of the global financial downturn. The Liberal Party believes that the way ahead for Australia is a path well trodden, for it is the legacy of the Liberal Party to the Australian people over the past 60 years and its consistent policy positions that have underpinned freedom and prosperity. The battle of ideas between Mr. Rudd's new left-wing ideology, some yet-to-be-defined form of socialist democracy with government intervention as the answer to all economic and social ills, and the Liberal Party's continued focus on individual rights, personal freedom, and economic choice, will become far more acute as Australia is buffeted by the winds of this economic downturn blowing from the cyclone of the global recession. By promoting some form of democratic socialism or social democracy as the new regime to emerge from the financial crisis, Mr. Rudd invites a critique of those countries and governments that in the past pursued the path of socialism in response to economic crises. Mr. Rudd has reignited the great debates of the past, socialism versus capitalism, regulation versus deregulation, protectionism versus free trade. During the dark years of the Depression, many people called for a more socialist approach of greater government regulation and greater involvement in people's daily lives. The claim was that markets had failed and therefore governments were the answer. Governments were best placed to decide on the choices confronting individuals. Liberals have always rejected this notion of greater government intervention, believing that individuals are better placed to decide what is best for them in any given circumstance. When individuals are empowered to be innovative, enterprising, and to use their initiative to pursue greater rewards, society as a whole benefits through increased employment and opportunity for others. There is a credible school of thought that President Roosevelt's New Deal and the policies of John Maynard Keynes and his followers, now so enthusiastically embraced by Mr. Rudd, actually prolonged the Great Depression by undermining confidence in the efficacy of markets and the capitalist system. Historian and author Paul Johnson noted in his introduction to Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, "It could be argued that the ultimate emotional and intellectual consequences of the Great Depression were not finally erased from the mind of humanity until the end of the 1980s, when the Soviet collectivist alternative to capitalism crumbled in hopeless ruin and the entire world accepted there was no substitute for the market." In that book, America's Great Depression, the fifth edition, released in 2000, Rothbard argued that the Great Depression was a failure, not of capitalism, but of a hyperactive state, and that Roosevelt's interventionist policies made the slump more severe and prolonged it until the Second World War. After the Great Depression and the horrors of World War II, many nations around the world found themselves at a crossroads faced with a choice of socialism or capitalism. In 1944, economist Friedrich Hayek published The Road to Serfdom, in which he warned of the dangers that centralised planning posed to liberty. At the time, he believed that England would nationalise its industries, and he warned that private ownership was essential to freedom and democracy. Hayek argued that free market capitalism was essential to the maintenance of democracy, for in a socialist economy, the interests of the individual were secondary to the interests of the collective. Here in Australia in 1942, Robert Menzies addressed the question of whether capitalism had failed. His answer was, "On the contrary, I think it has been, all things considered, an extraordinary success." He went on, "In envisaging the future world after the war, we should not seek to destroy this driving progressive element, which really represents one of the deep-seated instincts of man, but should seek to control and direct it in the interests of the people as a whole. In other words, the choice is not between an unrestricted capitalism and universal socialism. We shall do much better if we keep the good elements of the capitalist system while at the same time imposing upon capital the most stringent obligations to discharge its social and industrial duty." Those words became Liberal Party philosophy and hold true today. I contend that the solution to many of the problems currently facing our economy lie in the principles, philosophy and policies of the Liberal Party. If our goal is, as it must be, to emerge from the current economic downturn with the capacity to build a stronger economy while maintaining the fundamental, essential and enduring freedoms that our people currently enjoy, then it is the Liberal Party commitment to freedom and prosperity to which we must turn for guidance. The global financial crisis has resulted in calls for governments all around the world to increase their efforts to protect the interests of their citizens. As governments respond, it's vital they remember there can be far-reaching international and domestic consequences of their actions. One of the many consequences of governments providing massive cash handouts to supposedly stimulate their economies is that people buy imported goods. Political pressure then builds to better target spending on domestically produced goods and services. The United States, as part of its most recent $800 billion stimulus package included a Buy America provision that means infrastructure spending from the package must be used to buy goods manufactured in the United States. This has caused an outcry in countries including China, where this provision has been described as trade protectionism poison, which will have catastrophic effects on developing countries, let alone spark retaliatory trade wars. We are hopeful that the US-Australia Free Trade Agreement will protect Australian business and industry from the provisions of the Buy America clause. In 2003, I chaired the Joint Standing Committee on Treaties, and I well recall the scepticism of the Labor Party muttering darkly about the benefits of multilateralism rather than bilateralism in trade negotiations. Indeed, Mr. Rudd in opposition was highly critical of bilateral free trade agreements, even contending that bilateral free trade agreements had worsened Australia's export performance. Rising protectionism is often blamed for exacerbating the Great Depression, and if governments adopt similar inward-looking protectionist policies, those free trade agreements negotiated by the Howard government will prove to be of enormous benefit to our trade position. As Australia's growth slows, we must strive to increase trade by promoting the quality of Australian goods and services, both to our existing customers and to new markets with which we can establish trade agreements. The government's preference for multilateral agreements at the expense of bilateral agreements, as stated and articulated clearly in its 2007 election platform, must give way to reality. Multilateral agreements, through the complexity of gaining the consensus of a number of nations, require the investment of more time and more compromises than Australia can afford at present. The Rudd government needs to respond to the challenges facing Australia by working rapidly to expand the number of bilateral free trade agreements and by refocusing its efforts to the international relations issues that count, the Prime Minister's attempts to establish a European Union-style Asia-Pacific community is a case in point. But let me return to where I began, with Robert Menzies 60 years ago and his speech on the socialist challenge facing Australia at the 1949 election. It is, of course, historical fact that the Liberal Party under Robert Menzies won that election and took Australia in the direction of an open, market-based, competitive economy. The United States also put its faith in the value of markets and went on to become the greatest economic power the world has seen to date, with both nations committed to providing people with greater choice and greater opportunity. A number of countries adopted a more socialist approach to government at that time. The United Kingdom and New Zealand, among others, first embraced democratic socialism to varying degrees. It was not until the Thatcher reforms, later adopted by the Blair government, and the Rogernomic reforms of the mid-1980s in New Zealand that these economies became more open and dynamic. Until now, Australia has been relatively consistent in its embrace of market reforms with sensible deregulation and liberalisation. The new Rudd manifesto casts serious doubt on the path Labor will take us upon. One of the strongest motivations of people is to improve their standard of living and to provide a better standard of living for their families. People are aspirational. It is in our nature to strive for a better life. Australians are resourceful, ingenious, and inventive. Australians are also entrepreneurial. The Liberal Party believes it is essential to provide an economic environment which has incentive for individuals to work hard, to take risks, and which fosters entrepreneurial activity. The Liberal Party understands that it is the efforts of individuals that powers the economy, as they build small, medium, and large businesses. It is the efforts of these individuals through these enterprises which underpin employment. And it is the success of these people which provide the employment opportunities for fellow Australians. The Rudd government seems to think it can manipulate the economy through spending and driving up massive debt. The government has no money of its own. It can only spend money it either taxes or borrows. As it careers down the path to a $200 billion debt, this will weigh heavily on the nation's efforts to rebuild the economy. The Liberal Party knows, through the lessons of history and experience, that it's the efforts of individuals that creates wealth and prosperity. during a time of international turmoil, there can be a very great danger of overreaction. Mr. Rudd's manifesto has all the hallmarks of a massive overreaction. In Robert Menzies' 1942 series of radio broadcasts on the four freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear, he said there would always be temptation for those in power to limit the freedom of others. He quoted John Stuart Mill's famous essay Liberty, which said, "The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilised community against his will is to prevent harm to others." And Menzies described the essence of freedom as freedom for others as well as ourselves, freedom for people who disagree with us as well as for our supporters, freedom for minorities as well as for majorities. The history of the Liberal Party in government over the past 60 years has been true to those freedoms. Greater government intervention and control of the lives and choices of individuals has never been the answer. The Liberal Party remains true to its legacy, from Menzies to Howard and now to Turnbull, freedom and prosperity.
Can you get a drink of water? I think the air conditioning's off, so I've got some down the back. Many thanks, Julie Bishop. Thanks to Clayton Mutz for the use of this fine facility today. So we come to question and discussion. We've got till 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. You mentioned that after the war, Second War, Britain and New Zealand went the social democratic path, and Menzies put Australia somewhere between the United States on the one hand and the British New Zealand experiment on the other. And you spoke about the Menzies social safety net, or words to that effect. But by the end of the period, the social safety net was bearing a pretty heavy responsibility. And in the Howard government's last budget, I think something like 35% of payments went to welfare and family payments. I mean, as you now look back as deputy leader in the process of reviewing Liberal Party policy, are you kind of happy with a budget that's got 35% to family and welfare payments? Would you like it higher? Would you like it lower? Or how does that fit into your concept of the importance of the individual and individual initiative?
There is no doubt that the reality in Australia has been that there has been an increasing reliance on the state to provide support. And during times of high unemployment, for example, when unemployment reached 11% or a million people, there was a need for greater support for those out of work. We also have an ageing population, and that is a fact of life. Peter Costello's intergenerational report set out very starkly the challenges that our economy would face over the next 30, 40 years as a greater number of our population went into retirement and age compared with the taxpayer cohort because of the retirement of the baby boomer generation and the ageing of the population. That's why the government in those years focused on first boosting the birth rate through a number of policies. And we have seen, it's a bit like turning around the Queen Mary, but we have seen an increase in Australia's birth rate. This, of course, will take time. We also have seen a much greater focus on prevention, preventative policies in health to ensure that the burden of the health budget is not solely on treating chronic disease, for example, but that there will be preventionist policies that will ease that burden. I don't think any government would be of the centre-right persuasion would be entirely happy with the burden that is currently placed on the budget. The intergenerational report showed that it would be unsustainable in 20, 30, 40 years. Hence why we tried to focus on ensuring there were employment opportunities for people. More people in employment meant more people were self-sufficient, more people could afford private health insurance, for example. So many of our policies were directed to restoring that balance. But we were also pragmatic about the situation facing the country. had we remained in government, I believe we would have continued down the path of ensuring greater self-reliance for people. My point about the Rudd government manifesto, as articulated through Mr. Rudd's essay in the Monthly, is that the government appears to be going full circle, right back to a time when the government has all the answers. The government provides the thinking, the environment, the support for every ill facing society. And I see no return in that manifesto to the kind of policies that the Howard government had embarked upon to address the intergenerational issues.
There's no doubt over the Howard period that economically all those indicators you mentioned were looking very rosy. One of them that fails to get mentioned quite often is the size of the current account deficit over that period, which went from approximately $200 billion to approximately $600 billion under Howard's reign. Be that as it may, it was also preceded by a period in the Paul Keating years of fairly extreme economic structural reform over a range of different issues. Except, you know, I'm sure you're well aware that floating the dollar, deregulating the banks, etc. Can you, Howard, from what I can tell, put into place one major economic reform in terms of the GST? You might have got away with putting into work choices as another major structural economic reform that brought about those good economic indicators. What, if any, other major structural reforms did the Howard government put into place to achieve those good economic indicators, including the current account deficit?
Well, the Wallace reforms have been highlighted as one of the major reforms that has ensured that our finance and banking sector have remained robust throughout the financial crisis that has been gripping the rest of the world. Now, yes, there were reforms over the last 30 years, including the Hawke-Keating government, which is the very point we make about Mr. Rudd's slamming of the reforms of the last 30 years. He takes us back to Whitlam, whereas, of course, some of those most significant and important reforms were of the Hawke-Keating era, which we, in opposition, supported, as John Howard has made clear on many occasions, that when in opposition, we supported those efforts at deregulation and liberalisation that were introduced by Hawke and Keating. The same can't be said of the reforms introduced by the Howard government, including the GST. But I come back to the Wallace reforms. The setting up of APRA as a separate independent authority from the Reserve Bank is being hailed the world over as one of the reasons why our financial sector has not suffered in the same way as financial sectors overseas. The independence of the Reserve Bank, which the Howard government put in place, making the Reserve Bank independent, which was not only opposed by Labor, they actually sought legal advice to take Peter Costello to the High Court, claiming it was unconstitutional. That also has ensured that Australia has been more dynamic, more flexible in its ability to respond to the economic shocks around the world. I assume that is why the Deputy Prime Minister has boasted about our financial regulation and our banking sector. These were the very reforms from the Wallace inquiry that have underpinned the strength of the Australian banking and finance sector. We've not had our banks collapse. We've not had to nationalise our banks. Far from it, our banks, in the main, have still been reporting record profits.
Thank you. Your talk was actually about freedom and prosperity, yet you didn't really talk about freedom and what part of this is that. I'm just reminded of during APEC how we were locked out of our own city, and a few weeks later the government was brought it out. Australia isn't only an economy, we are a country of people. We are compassionate, resilient. And I was just wondering, in terms of your legacy with the Liberal Party, what is your legacy in terms of compassion?
Now, listen, we've got for an APEC here today, so I'll just repeat the question. It's a question about the Speaker should have focused more on freedom and what is the Liberal Party's attitude to the concept of compassion.
Well, in relation to freedom, I repeat, freedom is about choice, and the Liberal Party provided more choice to the Australian people in so many areas of their daily lives. In relation to workplace reforms from 1996, more choice for people to negotiate freely with their employers. In education, more choice for people to choose the kind of schooling they wanted for their children. In health, more choice for people to choose between the public and the private sector. In all that we did, our focus was on choice. For the Liberal Party, freedom and choice go hand in hand. In terms of your point about APEC APEC in the last few months of 2007, post-2001, post the attacks on the World Trade Center and Washington in the United States, there has obviously been a completely different approach to security concerning different nations of the world. And here we had some of the most important leaders of the world gathered in one place at one time. And one of the fundamental consequences of the fight against terrorism is that security in nations around the world has been increased dramatically. Now, to not take that action, I think, would be foolhardy. If there had been a terrorist attack in Australia in 2007 at the time of APEC, I don't think any government would have been justified in saying, ah, but we wanted our citizens to be free to move around the city on that day. It is a consequence of a terrible fight over freedom that means our soldiers are in Afghanistan today fighting for freedom. Our soldiers are in Afghanistan fighting to protect the very freedoms that we do enjoy and, of course, that we want to continue to enjoy. That was my point.
Bishop, if a term of government were to be returned tomorrow, how difficult is it, even notwithstanding the existence of the Australia-American Free Trade Agreement, to maintain existence of the relations between the two countries with the Obama administration? And what part might you as prospective Foreign Minister play?
The relationship between the United States and Australia has been strong, whomever has been in the respective administrations in Washington or in Canberra, and I would expect that the relationship would remain strong. We would work, as other governments have done, closely with the United States because we share some fundamental beliefs and fundamental values, and I think that transcends the changes in administration. I would, if I were Foreign Minister in a Turnbull government, I would continue to ensure that our relationship with the United States remains strong, that our free trade agreement was dynamic, not only by virtue of its existence, but that it did encourage free trade in goods and services between our countries, and, of course, work with the United States as it hopefully took an active interest in events in our part of the world. As I pointed out, some, like Niall Ferguson, fear that the United States will turn inwards because of the financial crisis it is facing. I would hope that countries like Australia could encourage the United States to continue to play its part in world affairs, particularly in our part of the world. And I, like others in Australia, am enthusiastic about the fact that President Obama has a particular personal connection with Indonesia that can only augur well for Australia, that the United States has an interest, through its president, a personal interest, in Indonesia, which is one of our most significant partners.
Congratulations on a good speech. I noticed that you quoted Niall Ferguson, Paul Johnson, and did every reference to that. I just wanted to know how stung you were by accusations of and how much input you had into the speech.
I was stunned by the accusations, and I wrote this speech, even typed it, and I can assure you my typing is laborious, but I typed it. As for Niall Ferguson, I met him in January of this year at Harvard Business School, and I spent some time discussing with him how he saw the consequences of the global financial crisis playing out in terms of the geopolitical scene. And if you've read his book, The Ascent of Money, or his book, The War of the World, he takes the lessons from history and applies them to the circumstances that we're currently facing. And whilst he doesn't fall for the trap of making sort of facile comparisons or parallels, drawing parallels between the current crisis and, say, the 20th century catastrophes, he does provide some compelling arguments that there are lessons to be learned and that we should not rush to embrace Roosevelt's New Deal policies, or we should not rush to embrace Keynesianism, for they are the policies that failed in the past, and there's no reason to believe that they will succeed in the future. So having spent some time with Niall Ferguson and others in the United States, I was inspired to write this speech for this evening.
I'd like to change the tenor, if I may, and it seems to me I'm certainly all for the individual and aggression, etc., but isn't that really what's led us into part of the problem here? I mean, institutional growth seems to be unlimited, or striving for it, and individuals have been striving to progress, and all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. Seems to me the liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, to society, and not getting into debt. Hence seems to be unlimited or striving for it. And individuals have been striving to progress. And all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. Seems to me the liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, to society, and not getting into debt.
And middle road. But the current financial crisis began in the United States, and many have gone over the reasons for this crisis. But essentially, it was a failure of policy, of regulation, of management. It was not a failure of the capitalist system per se. And that's why I'm warning against an overreaction, as exemplified in Mr. Rudd's manifesto, where he throws the capitalist system out the door. What I'm saying is, yes, there were failures, policy, regulatory, management, but they can all be addressed. But I also point out that it seems somewhat ironic that the crisis came about because of excessive debt, yet this government believes that greater government debt is the answer. That is nonsensical to me. If this crisis is based on excessive indebtedness, why is the government taking this country deeply into debt?
My question is just around how does the Liberal Party respond to the argument that the economic success was just riding away into the resources of the government? Where's the balance there?
One of the great lies of the Rudd government's rewriting of history is that we squandered the benefits of the resources boom. Far from it. There was a $166 billion investment from the resources boom, paying off $96 billion in Labor Party debt and setting aside $70 billion in the Future Fund, as well as delivering successive surpluses. So just on a monetary front, we most certainly utilised the benefits of the resources boom to the benefit of Australia. Hence, an economy that has provided the Rudd government with so many options in dealing with the current financial crisis, the money put away for a rainy day. In relation to the mining boom, I think it's worth pointing out that had it not been for the labour market reforms that were embraced, particularly in the northwest of Western Australia, in the Pilbara in particular, Australia would not have been in a position to capitalise on the mining boom. If we had not had a liberalised labour market where the rate of industrial disputation fell from 150 strikes a year for one producer of iron ore to zero, we would not have been considered to be a reliable trading partner. China would have gone elsewhere for its resources to feed its energy needs. So one of the huge benefits of the Howard years was the flexibility in our labour markets that essentially meant we could be a trusted and reliable supplier of iron ore and other resources out of the Pilbara. I fear one of the consequences of the Labor government's new employment laws is that we will see a return of industrial disputation in the Pilbara in particular, and that will send a warning signal to our trading partners that Australia can no longer be relied upon to be a consistent supplier of resources.
I have a quick question here. Most day-to-day government services are delivered at state level. How do you, as the deputy leader of the federal government, view the lack of success of Liberals at the state level in the context of the overall?
Well, let's hope that that's about to change. I come from Western Australia, and the people have seen the damage that a Labor government can do to a state over time, and there was a change of government against all odds, against the perceived wisdom of the commentators, but the Western Australian people voted in a Liberal government, and Colin Barnett's government is already proving to be decisive. They are acting upon some of the failures of the past and are getting on with the job of creating opportunities for Western Australians. Sure, its budget is going to be in a difficult position. Talk about wasting the proceeds of a mining boom. The Labor government in Western Australia managed to cause havoc in a budget, even though the royalties flowing into the state budget were massive. Likewise, in Queensland, I am very hopeful that there will be a change of government in Queensland in just a couple of weeks' time, so that a Liberal National Party will be able to restore good governance and appropriate levels of accountability to the state of Queensland. Now, there are obviously many reasons why the people of New South Wales continue to put up with an incompetent and inept Labor government at the state level. I'm afraid that I don't understand it, but I hope that Barry O'Farrell and his team will be able to win the next state election and again restore New South Wales to a position of prosperity and strength, a position that it has been lacking for a decade or more.
Many thanks. Please take a seat.
Well, I've always been an admirer of Julie Bishop, and this is her third visit to the Sydney Institute, once as a virtually unknown backbencher, once as a senior cabinet minister, and now as deputy leader of the opposition. And it was very good tonight to hear Julie Bishop talk, both as the shadow minister for foreign affairs, but more broadly as the deputy leader of the opposition across a range of policy, and to handle questions so deftly. So many thanks for coming on tonight. We'll see you again next time, but also thanks to Clayton for the facility tonight. And
you have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.
Seems to be unlimited or striving for it. Do you think? And individuals have been striving to progress, and all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. Seems to me the Liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, for society, and not getting into debt. Hence seems to be unlimited or striving for it. And individuals have been striving to progress, and all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. It seems to me the Liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, to society, and not getting into debt. Hence seems to be unlimited or striving for it, and individuals have been striving to progress, and all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. Seems to me the Liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, to society, and not getting into debt. Hence seems to be unlimited or striving for it, and individuals have been striving to progress, and all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. Seems to me the Liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, to society, and not getting into debt. Hence seems to be unlimited or striving for it, and individuals have been striving to progress, and all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. Seems to me the Liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, to society, and not getting into debt. Hence seems to be unlimited or striving for it, and individuals have been striving to progress, and all of them, both of them, getting into greater and greater debt. Seems to me the Liberals have got to start to think about where to strike a balance between the rights and the freedom of the individual in terms of their obligations, whether it be an institution or an individual, to society.